From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Mark, Eric, welcome back. A busy week indeed, eh?
Oh, yes.
Yes,
oh,
indeed, yeah. Even with your Canadian phraseology.
I guess we start this week with Eric. We're talking, I guess, about Syria and Iraq. Word is that the Iraqi government has requested the Russian Federation to send in the Air Force and take care of ISIS.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, there's a couple of things that are interesting about that, actually, and I'm sure Mark will have some additional input on this. But first and foremost, I think that it illustrates the fact that forgetting what Russia's talking points are from Russian media and Russian sources, I think that sources in the region see that what Russia is doing in Syria is incredibly effective. I think that they, when they look at these precision strikes, when they look at what progress has been made in just, you know, 72 hours or 96 hours or however long it's been of this bombing, I think the Iraqis see very clearly that it's making tangible progress, that they're attacking key nodes within the Islamic State's infrastructure, that the Islamic State is actually being degraded relatively quickly, and most importantly, that the bombing of these Islamic State targets actually provides an opening for on-the-ground military forces to make real progress, which is ultimately where the true battle in Syria is going to be. And I think that in Iraq, naturally, that is a similar situation. And so the Baghdad authorities undoubtedly see this as a tremendous potential opening for them to make real progress. And ultimately, from the perspective of Baghdad, hopefully to recapture Mosul, to recapture Ramadi, and to reestablish some semblance of authority over these key cities and key regions. Now, I don't think that the central authorities in Baghdad are so unrealistic as to believe they're going to be able to pacify all of Anbar. I think that's impossible. But to make inroads enough to be able to reassert themselves in Ramadi, I think that's quite possible. And I think that they think that Russian help is going to be the key factor in that. Now, the second thing that I want to say that I find fascinating about this is that Russian moves are actually beginning to build, or maybe we could say rebuild, a very important strategic alliance here, and namely to recast Iraq in this Iran-Iraq-Syria-Hezbollah alliance, this, let's call it Shia alliance, although it's not a purely sectarian one. But this alliance, this arc of Shia power, the stretching from Tehran all the way to the Mediterranean coast in Lebanon, if this is truly reconstituted and rebuilt under the aegis of, if not Russian leadership, at least Russian support in the background, I think that that is a huge development in the region. Because remember, the U.S. soft coup against Maliki, which effectively removed him from power, was an attempt to break that alliance, to essentially remove Iraq from the equation and thereby separate Iran from Syria. And this actually is now showing itself to be a major development. Because if you do have a rebuilt alliance of that kind with Russia's background support in all of this, this actually essentially creates the important block against the expansion of Wahhabi extremism. Now, from the Russian perspective, obviously they have a self-interested motive in doing that in terms of their own issues with Wahhabi extremism in the Caucasus region. But also, this is evidence of the growing partnership that Russia has with Iran, as we've seen with the transfer of the S-300 technology, as we've seen with some of the other moves and statements made in recent weeks and months. And I think it, again, not to beleaguer the important point here, but Russia's back, baby.
Yeah, Eric, you took some of the very words out of my mouth that I was speaking to Don with this about just a little bit earlier. Let me go back, but I'll go a little bit further. The important context to the immediate this shift by Iraq is that, as you said, the U.S. pressured, basically had removed al-Maliki, who was seen more of a Shia hardliner in the last year, in a soft coup, and replaced by al-Abadi, who was considered more amenable to U.S. interests and more moderate. Something has radically changed within the last few months, that al-Abadi has so suddenly made such a radical geopolitical shift towards Russia when, you know, Iraq, ever since the invasion and occupation, you know, has still been playing largely as a U.S. client state, although growing closer to Iran all the time because of the Shia majority. We see this evidenced as first, al-Abadi gave Russia flyover rights over Iraq. And this was very crucially important because Bulgaria had, under U.S. pressure, blocked Russia from flying over. And Turkey certainly wasn't going to allow Russia to fly military gear to Syria over Turkey. So that, you know, the Black Sea Basin airspace was closed. So through the Caucasus and then down into Iraq and over to Syria was crucial air flight corridor. This the U.S. was extremely upset about, and this was made, you know, public. Then al-Abadi openly joined with this new anti-ISIS coalition with the Syrian government, Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, and announced this military and intelligence coordination center in Iraq, where they will be sharing their intel on what's going on with all of these other players. And U.S. intelligence officials were furious about this because evidently Iraq has at least a portion of U.S. intelligence on what exactly is going on in the region. And of course, we'll know some of what the U.S. is really up to. And then the third, just coming out today, there's been lots of little hesitant talking about it in recent days. But within the last hour, Al Jazeera has reported that al-Abadi has officially requested Russia to enter Iraqi airspace, which is should be thick with American and their allies' aircraft, and bomb ISIS there. So why? Why is this happening? You have to ask yourself. And I will posit, it's not only because they see Russia as being more effective, okay? And remember, the United States has supposedly been at war with ISIS for the last year with over 8,000 sorties. Mm-hmm. And at a cost of billions. And the word from the defense from the Pentagon is that ISIS has not been significantly degraded and has lost no territory in Syria. They've grown and they've only lost rather marginal, unimportant territory in Iraq. So my theory is that the Iraqi government has seen that the U.S. is not playing this game to beat ISIS. They're not trying to defeat ISIS. They're trying to manage them. They're trying to manage them as a strategic asset to leverage the government in Baghdad, but more importantly, for regime change in Syria. And until that is complete, they have no intentions of defeating ISIS. And I think they know, as well as I think most people realize, that ISIS will never be completely defeated in the sense that Iraq and Syria will take back all their territory. I think the U.S. is firmly set on the idea that there will be a partition and essentially a Sunni state wedged in between Syria and Iraq. And this goes to the geopolitical point I think we're all familiar with that Eric brought up, this Shia Crescent arc that has U.S. geopoliticians so frenzied, and which is the entire rationale for the U.S. obsession with regime change in Syria. This arc of Shia influence stretching from Iran through Iraq and Syria, Lebanon, to the Atlantic. And the reason that this arc exists, of course, is because of the U.S. Ill-fated military adventures, regime change in Iraq. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that if you give a Shia majority population full democracy, that that majority is going to move closer to Iran, and that is exactly what happened. And it completely shows the absolute idiocy, not just of the Bush administration, but of the U.S. deep state. You know, the military, the intelligence, that the foreign policy, the State Department, that didn't jump in firmly enough to say, don't you know what you're doing? Or in Putin's words, don't you even realize what you have done?
But, you know, and, on that point, let me ask here about this. The legacy, of course, you know, the fact that you have this division between Shia and Sunnis that it expresses politically across that region is the legacy of imperial power, you know, that played on those divisions to maintain itself in the first place. And then when the U.S. went into Iraq, both in 91, but more particularly in 2003, that was precisely what they used to decapitate the Iraqi state, because that had been dominated by Sunnis and the majority of the population were.
One more small point, and yeah. I think it's very important. It plays on this question of the Sunni-Shia divide, particularly in Iraq. The U.S. Has refused to use their air power, evidently, in support of Iraq's Shia militias. And Iraq's Shia militias have been the most effective military tool, far more effective than the U.S.-trained military, which has divided ethno-religious loyalties in the fight against ISIS. So with the U.S. refusing to use its air power in support of these Shia militias, and Iran effectively helping to train and lead them, evidently, this is that was, I guess, the final straw for Iraq, because they're saying on our end, we need these Shia militias to take back territory. You know, all your airstrikes in the world, even if they actually are seriously targeted, which I have doubts about, cannot make up for a lack of a ground force, which is exactly why Russia's airstrikes in Syria will have much greater, and now theoretically in Iraq, will have much greater effect than any even theoretical U.S. airstrikes, because you need ground forces to take and hold territory that air power helps clear.
Okay, and then in addition to this, you have the background when they were pushing Maliki out and bringing in the current government. ISIS was actually being leveraged at that point by the United States as a part of that process, which supports what both of you have been saying. So on that, Eric, what do you think in terms of the perceptions of the Iraqi government? And maybe they even, you know, since they're the ones that benefited from the U.S. interjection at that point, maybe the U.S. was saying to them, look, we got these guys to take care of that.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things. Number one, the United States, the United States never wanted Maliki in place in the first place. Remember, originally the neocons wanted their man Ahmed Chalabi to take over control in Iraq. He was completely unpopular, but also kind of a buffoon and really mismanaged his own political position and was unable to do so. Then they wanted Ayad Alawi, who currently runs the Iraqiya bloc in the Iraqi government. He was also unpopular and was not really able to consolidate enough support to take over. So Maliki was essentially a third choice, a third option, and they were somewhat hesitant with Maliki because they knew that not only were his loyalties towards the Shia population, but that he was a strong-headed nationalistic leader who understood the importance of allying with Iran. And that's ultimately what happened when Maliki was in power. So pushing Maliki out of power was essentially a power move by the United States against Iran to try to deprive Iran Iran of its growing influence in Iraq. And that's really how I think it needs to be understood. And that ties into this question about the Shia militias on the ground in Iraq. It is the United States that fears any potential growth of Shia power, be it military power, be it political power inside of Iraq. They also fear the potential for government purges. And this is an important point that nobody talks about. There are a number of agents inside of the Iraqi government whose loyalties are not to Iraq as a nation, but to specific U.S.-backed factions in Iraq, especially Chalabi's people, who still have very important positions in the central bank in Iraq, who are very influential in handing out contracts, and who have very deep contacts within the military. And so when we're talking about Iraq's military now looking at Russia, we're also seeing a sea change in terms of the loyalties of these institutions. And I think that that's really important as well. Maliki was seen as an enemy by the United States. He closed down Camp Ashraf, which was the main jumping off point, you know, launching point for Mujahideen e Khalq in terms of their attacks against Iran. He moved to consolidate power. He moved to shut out the Wahhabi networks as best as he could. And he was in many ways going against some of the key U.S. agents in the government. And so and I can't even get into all of the reasons why they really disliked Maliki, especially his desire to stand by Assad and to be part of oil pipelines bringing Iranian energy to the Mediterranean via Iraq. So there's a number of reasons. And of course, also the oil factor here is really important because Maliki was unwilling to allow the Kurds to make their own deals. He insisted that the Kurdish North must be subordinated to the authority of Baghdad, and B, he refused to bend to the will of ExxonMobil and BP and the other major Western oil companies who wanted to dictate terms to the Iraqi government. So there's a million reasons why Maliki had to go. And now that we see the post-Maliki government moving away from the United States, I think it illustrates, and I think this is where Mark was going with it, the precariousness of the U.S. position. Now, to be fair, the U.S. is not simply going to take all of this lying down. They're going to have a strategy for pushing back against this. Now, what that means most likely is fomenting further sectarian divides inside of Iraq. One of the things that the United States has been very good at, especially over the last few years, is fueling these tribal conflicts in the Anbar province and fueling the sectarian conflict inside of Iraq. If the U.S. sees that the government that it installed, the post-Maliki government under Abadi, is not acting as a reliable puppet, then what they're going to do is work to undermine that government in whatever way they can. And the main way that they do that, and this was something that came up in Congress, the Senate Armed Services Committee had moved a few months ago to arm the Sunni and Kurdish factions inside of Iraq outside of the authority of Baghdad. In other words, bypassing the central government in Baghdad and sending arms directly to the tribal groups, the Sunni tribal groups in Anbar, and to the Kurds as well. Now, what that means is de facto civil war, or at least de facto partitioning of the country. And the result of that was what we saw in Ramadi, where the Islamic State is able to move in and seize territory because the Iraqi military is not in a position to be able to defend territory when they're essentially fighting a multi-front conflict on the battlefield and politically as well. Now, I think to be fair, from contacts that I've spoken with who have spoken to people in the Iraqi military, it's not that they're incompetent and it's not that they're unwilling to take on the Islamic State. It's that they have to be very careful about how they do that because they cannot alienate a lot of these Sunni tribes, especially in the Anbar province. Some of these tribes are not pro ISIS, but they are definitely hesitant to ally with Baghdad and the Shia government and the Shia majority. So they have to negotiate a lot of these very complex, very difficult sectarian issues, and that is what the United States plays on. We all know the age-old story of imperialism's divide and rule, divide and conquer, the way that the British used that strategy all throughout the Middle East, the way that the French did as well. The United States, of course, it goes without saying. This is really, I think, in the forefront of what's happening in Iraq. Now, as we see, though, and as Mark was alluding to, and I, of course, agree 100%, there is a growing – and I think I've argued this point on this show a number of times. There is a growing awareness in Iraq that what the United States has been doing over the course of the last year, and in fact, the Defense Intelligence Agency memo of 2012 says it's been going on for more than 3 years now. And that is not destroying the Islamic State, but managing its development, directing it where they want it to go, bombing it when it goes against their strategies, leaving it alone when it doesn't. I think that that was illustrated for the Iraqi government very clearly in the attack on Mosul and then especially the attack on Ramadi. Look, the Russians don't have superior surveillance to the United States, and the Russians can tell you exactly where Islamic State facilities are. They can tell you where these trucks are moving, where they're coming from, where they're going. Of course, the United States could do that as well. If anybody wants to argue that the United States didn't see hundreds of trucks on the move into Ramadi, that would be outlandish to say the least. Of course they did. There was obviously a strategic decision made on the part of the United States and, of course, the Iraqi military secondarily that they were not going to do anything about it. In other words, they were going to allow the Islamic State to seize Ramadi, the most strategically important city in the Anbar province, that is the west of Iraq. And we see, of course, the implications of that, the ripple effect to this day. So we are seeing, as I mentioned earlier, a sea change in Iraq where the government has now decided the United States is not a reliable partner in fighting against the Islamic State, and now they're looking to Russia in order to fill that void of a reliable partner. Also, and I'll finish on this point here, the growing sense is that both on the Syrian side of the border and the Iraqi side of the border, these militaries are both preparing for major ground offensives. And these ground offensives are going to be made possible by the Russian air strikes. Now, this is a very critical moment in this conflict because it is impossible to make significant gains against the Islamic State if you don't have major air power, major air superiority. And although the Syrian Air Force is very much capable, the Iraqis have some semblance of an air force as well, nothing on the scale of what the Russians can do in terms of precision bombing, in terms of targeting, all of this. So with Russian help, there could actually be a major push on the ground. And if that happens, they might not destroy the Islamic State entirely, but they can make enough inroads and they can force enough confusion and enough desertion and enough dissension within the ranks of the Islamic State that they are significantly degraded to the point where progress, real progress, can be made.
Yeah, I'll just add to that first of all, it's not just the Russian air power that is crucial, but also Russian intelligence.
Yes,
specifically
absolutely.
Russian satellite intelligence, which, as we you made perfectly clear, that the U.S. has obviously been denying to the Iraqi government over the last year, or handing it out piecemeal as suited their interests as they try to prune ISIS as a strategic asset, as the aforementioned infamous DIA memo attained by Judicial Overwatch, clearly indicated how they would view such a Salafist principality as a strategic asset. Let's not forget that Iraq has to keep firmly in mind that the very first country to jump and provide real assistance when ISIS first began taking Iraqi cities was Russia. Within 48 hours, they had fighter jets in Baghdad, flown from Russia, you know, sold to them at bargain basement prices, evidently, in order to facilitate the strikes against ISIS. And obviously that is, you know, playing in the back of the Iraqi leaders' minds. Eric brought up an excellent point that I think it would behoove us to elaborate a little bit on. This use of it's nothing new. This use of the U.S. Fomenting ethno-religious, political, economic, social divides as a weapon of U.S. foreign policy. This is, as you mentioned, a time and true method of imperialism. You know, in fact, I think even Russia, you know, certainly used this formula in Chechnya. You know, as the Chechen War was primarily a civil war, Chechens killing Chechens far more than Russians or Chechens killing each other, and certainly played to a Chechen loyal faction, which has rebuilt Chechnya, Kadyrov. But this policy is, this general idea has been formulated by the United States into an art and a science. And we're talking a codified science. Any of you can go online and Google the U.S. Unconventional Warfare Manual of the U.S. Exactly. Military.
Yep.
All right. This very clearly states the idea of unconventional warfare is to foment and use existing ethno-religious, political, economic, social divides as a weapon of U.S. foreign policy. To turn the people of a country on their own government in order to fulfill U.S. policy interests. And we can see so many examples of this, not just in Iraq, of course, but in Ukraine, with the support for the neoliberal ultranationalist putsch, which took over the country, you know, primarily whose primary constituents are West Ukraine, you know, Galicia. But we've seen this repeatedly. You know, U.S. State Department support for Uyghurs in China. In Syria, the support for this Sunni Islamist and Salafist constituency, which, while Sunnis are the majority of the Syrian population, they are significant minorities, Christians, Alawites, Shia, Druze, Yazidi, but also Sunni who don't adhere to this more radical, extreme form of Islam, Salafism. And those are the divides in Syria that we have today. And there is, of course, a consequence to using this unconventional warfare as the primary U.S. Foreign policy weapon to enact their interests around the world. Every country they use it in, they break the country permanently. Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, Iraq, and now Syria.
Code of War.
It breaks nations permanently.
Yep.
Let me talk to that point for a minute, because it's a two-edged sword too. Well, you know, once you spin the top, you know, it's like a gyroscope in outer space almost. It just continues to spin. You have, for example, the use of this particular strategy or tactic against Iraq, and also as a lever against Turkey with the Kurds back in 1990-1991. And then you see, of course, the Kurds taking the fight to ISIS without regard for the U.S. strategy there. In fact, in apparent opposition. And then there's another aspect to this, too, where you can see it being played out, and that's in Egypt. If you go back 55 years, you saw the formulation of a pan-Arab state with Egypt, Syria, and soon to be, but never to be, Iraq. And now we saw the forces on the ground with al-Sisi coming to power against Muslim Brotherhood government, which kind of leaves Egypt almost in a position to join with whatever ends up maturing out of the move that seems to be creating this.
Oh yes, I think Egypt is definitely on board with this.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I guess I can speak to that in a second, but I just want to add to what Mark was saying, and Don, what you're pointing out as well. Look, it's not just a sectarian issue here. This is the misnomer, I think, the misconception that a lot of people, even supposed experts on the region, leave out. They'll always talk about the sectarian divides and ethnic divides in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere, but they often fail to mention clan, tribal, and family loyalties and divides, which are really important, especially in places like Libya, where you didn't have a sectarian divide, which was a Sunni country, but you had these clan loyalties and tribal loyalties that were really critical, that the divides between them were fomented, and that is ultimately how Libya was broken up, and that is really, in fact, how Libya is today. It is essentially a loose collection of tribal groups, familial groups, extended families, clans, and so forth. You see something very similar in Iraq, in the Anbar province. A lot of these groups, as I mentioned, they're not, they're Sunni, but they're not 100%, enamored with being part of the Islamic State. Either they don't want to wage endless jihad in the extremist fashion that the Islamic State does, or they have, various other misgivings, or the Islamic State is horning in on their action in terms of organized crime and many other things, trafficking, who knows what else. So there are a lot of these groups that are potentially willing to fight against the Islamic State if they are in various ways cajoled into doing so. And the competition between these various tribal groups and factions, the competition over influence with them, this is also a critical point that the United States is definitely trying to exploit here.
They used it in the Anbar uprising.
Yeah,
this famous, supposedly brilliant U.S. strategy, and which, the arming of so many of these, we really have to wonder how much that led, fueled the creation of the rise of the Islamic State.
Well, and also it was used as a weapon against Maliki. They wanted to make Anbar ungovernable for the Maliki government. And those the move to get rid of Maliki really emerged out of a protest movement situated in Anbar. And that protest movement was fueled and fomented by the United States as a weapon against Maliki. And so anyway, my point here is that when we're talking about what the U.S. pushback against what Russia is doing and this growing alliance, we have to understand that the U.S. pushback is multifaceted and it is nuanced, and they have a strategy of tension, they have a strategy of divisions, and they're very, very good at it. And I think that this is really going to be what we're going to need to follow in the coming weeks and months, how the U.S. exploits these divisions and where that money, where those weapons are going to flow into in Iraq. Because if Russia starts bombing Islamic State positions in Iraq and the Iraqi military starts making progress, this is going to be a disaster scenario for the United States. So their counter strategy is going to be further division, further ethnic tension, further divide and rule. And I think that's the important. And again, Yemen is a similar scenario. In Yemen, they have infused the Islamic State. Al Qaeda is very prevalent there. Yemen is barely even a functioning state, if we can even call it that at all. And it's also breaking down into these tribal groups. But you also have an alliance there, this Houthi Saleh forces alliance, which is more or less holding together the anti-Saudi coalition there. That is
which includes Sunni tribes in the south of
right.
The country.
Exactly.
Let me point out the similarities between Yemen and Iraq, and partially explain the reason that so many gave allegiance in Iraq to, or at least acquiescence and coordinated fighting with ISIS. And that is, of course, after the U.S. invasion and occupation, there was inevitably the precondition for a war of national liberation. At some point in time, when you occupy people, they organize themselves to tell you to get the hell out. And that was suppressed and confused and broken up with all of these different techniques that you're describing. And yet the current is there. And when ISIS appeared to be the only alternative to the United States, it started to draw in the former military, Sunnis, and others from Iraqi society. And now that you're seeing a genuine alternative, a non-head-chopping, crazed alternative present itself or start to formulate, I'm guessing you're going to see people lining up in Iraq behind it in the same way that you're seeing unity among the people in Yemen to fight off the Saudis and ultimately the U.S.
Yeah, I want to say, though, and I want to be clear about something here, because I think that there is definitely an element of truth in that. However, there is a misconception, I think, in the West, or, you know, just in general outside of the region.
The nation states are artificial Western constructs in the first place. I understand soil.
But I mean to say that a lot of those former Ba'athists who they, you know, characterized as becoming part of the Islamic State push into Iraq, part of it was because they were drawn in for a number of reasons, revenge and whatever else. But the Islamic State really provided a major avenue for enriching themselves. This is, the important point here. You had black market oil being sold, weapons being smuggled, human trafficking, all of these things which are worth billions of dollars. A lot of these former Ba'athists who had resources, contacts, networks that they were still plugged into, they saw in the rise of the Islamic State not just a chance to fight back against the Shia power center in Baghdad, but a chance to enrich themselves. And I think that that has happened to a large extent, and a lot of them have gotten very rich off of it, to the point where now they're saying, well, I've made my money, I've gotten my payday, now it's time to push back against these guys and to try to eject them and to grow my own power. So there is an internal power struggle happening that is not purely along ideological or political lines. It's also along economic lines, and it's very simply a question of survival.
Yeah, I don't contest any of that, but let's also recall we have a testimony asserting it, that a number of these former Ba'athists, high-ranking military up to and including generals, who joined ISIS and have made it so capable on the ground, albeit expanding in a power vacuum, have made it so capable, these generals, they were prisoners of the United States, the U.S. occupation in Iraq. They've freely admitted this. They were prisoners of the United States, and they were tortured. And during their incarceration and torture for years, they found, many of them found, and certainly made contacts with, with this Salafist version of Islam. So even if they didn't fully adopt to it, they certainly made the contacts with the people who did. And this is yet more blowback on this U.S. Use of this unconventional warfare divide and rule strategy. But I'd like to also mention that the U.S. does not have a strategy certainly not in Syria, and I would extend that to Iraq as well. Obama has no coherent strategy. There are vague neocon dreams, of course, of shattering this Shia arc of influence, but they have no firm strategy to do this. They are jumping from the tactical level of using unconventional warfare to geopolitical dreams without any realistic military strategy to accomplish that. And part of that has been this mythological belief that they could insert these Chalabi, U.S. Cultured neoliberals into Iraq, that they could somehow turn the FSA, this branded militia with a core of CIA trained, into a real force in Syria, which it has never been and will never be, because it is not representative of what the uprising is, which is, Salafist Islam. So there is no realistic strategy. And this is borne out in the past week during the UNGA speeches, the dueling UNGA speeches of Putin and Obama during the UN General Assembly. Nancy Youssef, a senior defense editor for the Daily Beast, and yes, the Daily Beast, a completely neocon creature, but I think we can trust her on this. She tweeted that she was talking while this was happening with senior Pentagon officials who told her that they were listening to Obama's UNGA speech to try to divine what his strategy for ISIS was. Not only does this tell you that the U.S. has no real strategy and that the military is well and painfully aware of it for dealing with ISIS, but that the U.S. Is the White House is completely at odds with its own military and intelligence forces at this point. There are problems in the marital bed. Someone is sleeping on the couch at this point.
Yeah.
And this dysfunction in Washington over strategy and over, you know, perhaps a bigger geopolitical picture plays itself out in the absolutely disastrous Obama support for, you know, these, you know, a training of 10,000 plus CIA trained, armed and paid, salary paid Islamists, but thinking that that is a large enough force without overt U.S. military regime change to really swing Syria. And it's not. And the result has been this ongoing 5-year bloody sectarian civil war cum proxy war. And in steps Russia to say, this is a mess. You need to realize what you've done. We're going to help you clear it up. I sincerely hope that you are smart enough to realize that actually what I am doing here is throwing you a lifeline and giving you an off-ramp for your own failed policies.
You know, there's one word that we haven't mentioned yet that I'm just going to say, and then you guys jump on it. And that word is China.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a couple of things to say about China. I'm going to leave aside the rumors of Chinese military involvement in Syria, because at this point, I think they're just rumors. And
I haven't seen any confirmation.
Yeah, they're just rumors floating around in the blogosphere and such. And I don't think that we can really make too much of a case that there's any hard evidence of that. But I mean, it's possible. Maybe in the coming weeks, we'll be talking about it. But what I do think is interesting is a couple of things that Xi Jinping said in his address at the UN General Assembly. Number one, if people watched his speech, I think that there is one or maybe two key phrases that we can
pinpoint, well actually three, but
two key phrases that we could pinpoint that I think sum up what China was saying, what Xi Jinping was saying to the world. Number one is non-interference. In other words, countries have the right to develop how they see fit, and we shouldn't be meddling in the internal affairs of every country. Now, this is standard Chinese policy. This is something that they have always employed in terms of their involvement in investments, their involvement in diplomatic relations, and so forth. But he was really not simply reiterating Chinese policy. He was making the point, the same point that Putin made in a much less direct way, which is generally speaking the Chinese method of doing things, that what we see in terms of global imperialism from the United States, regime change, exporting color revolutions, all of the points that Putin had made, Xi Jinping really simply said, let countries deal with their own issues, and China will always be backing sovereignty. This was the key phrase that was repeated multiple times. Sovereignty, the sovereignty of nations to determine their own fate. Now, on the one hand, Xi Jinping was sort of making a claim against what the U.S. policy has been and continued to be. At the same time, he's speaking about U.S. relations with China. In other words, leave us to deal with our own problems. Stop meddling in the affairs of China, namely the South China Sea, the relations, bilateral versus multilateral relations with other countries in Southeast Asia, the dispute over the Diaoyu/Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea between China and Japan, and a number of other issues. But even
Taiwan,
of course, which is always in the background, yes, and Tibet, obviously, which is also always in the background, and the question of Xinjiang with the Uyghur population, you know, a lot of these internal issues. But at the larger level, there is the, you know, the elephant in the room in terms of China's international relations, and that has to do with Russia, the China-Russia alliance, the growing importance of the BRICS Development Bank, and all of these other issues. And really what China is talking about is the New Silk Road, the European Economic Union, all of these railroads and highways and the China-Pakistan relation, all of these things happening in Asia. China has sent a clear message to the United States that you are not going to be able to stop this and you shouldn't even try. And this is important because what the United States policy has continued to be is to try to sow divisions within China's society using its NGO network in Xinjiang with the Uyghurs, using the Tibet issue, using the South China Sea issue, all the things that I have already mentioned, China pushed back against that. Now, on the international level, though, China was also saying something really important. Remember, Xi Jinping said something that really, I was a little taken aback by it. I thought it was a brilliant rhetorical strategy when he said that China's vote in the Security Council will always belong to the developing nations. That was a really, I think, if Putin had his masterstroke with, do you realize what you've done? I think that the developing nations point was China's, Xi Jinping's masterstroke, because not only was he saying that China maintains these very close relations with all these countries where it's investing in Africa, in Latin America, that China will uphold all of these countries. I mean, we've seen massive loan deals made with Venezuela, which has been economically hemorrhaging in a lot of ways. We've seen massive infusion of Chinese investments all over the African continent, which is, of course, well documented as well. So China was simply reiterating that it is a partner for all of these countries in the developing world, which again is the vast majority of the world. At the same time, China was also sending, I think, a very clear, though maybe let's call it subtextual, message to the United States, namely that China's investment strategy and economic engagement and economic penetration, especially in a place like Africa, is not going to be stymied and stifled by U.S. military expansion and military strategy. In other words, when the U.S. is expanding AFRICOM all over the African continent, literally in almost every country on the continent, it is to block Chinese economic development there. And China is saying, A, we know what you're doing, and B, we're going to stand with our developing country partners. Now, this is really critical because remember, what China represents for, you know, countries like Nigeria or Ethiopia or Mozambique or any of these countries really in Africa, China represents an alternative, a viable alternative to the IMF, World Bank, Wall Street, Washington, London system. And that is critical. And when China says that their vote in the Security Council belongs to the developing world, what they're actually saying is we represent our partners all over the world and U.S. hegemony is not going to change that. Now, that to me was a very powerful moment in that speech because essentially it was throwing down the gauntlet to the United States, saying that all of these machinations like splitting Sudan to deprive China of its main African partner, like fomenting chaos in Somalia and in the Horn of Africa, in Yemen, in in all of these countries, isolating Eritrea, moving towards Ethiopia militarily, trying to pull Kenya back into the U.S. sphere of influence. All of these moves in East Africa, in Southern Africa, isolating Zimbabwe, doing what they did in Libya, all of these things will not change the Chinese strategy of engagement. And I think that that is really critical, especially when you see the growth of these anti-government movements all over Latin America, where China is a key ally of the government in Ecuador, the government in Bolivia, the government in Brazil, the government in Venezuela. These are really important developments. And I know a lot of people didn't really comment on this, but I think it is in many ways almost as significant, if not equally significant, to what Putin said in terms of U.S. policy. Now, when you have a sort of synchronicity between the message coming out of Moscow and the message coming out of Beijing, this is a very important indicator of the radical, you know, let's call it a tectonic shift that we've seen in geopolitics just in the last few years, because up until very recently, it was almost unthinkable that the leader of China and the leader of Russia would be echoing each other at the UN.
I just have three points, small points to that. One, not only does China provide a developmental partner in the third world, an alternative, but more importantly, and exactly on theme with what you're saying, I'm sure you'll agree with me, that it is a partner, a developmental partner that invests and develops, but at the same time does not dictate a radical shift, an adoption of Western political and ideological system through the Washington consensus and its antecedents.
And let me just add one other point. Exactly right. And also, China does not saddle you with endless cycles of debt.
Well, and exactly that political ideological system, of course, that the West insists for development strategy, the core of that, that, you know, shows you how farcical it really is always privatization, which, of course, completely opens these countries to forever being client states to the U.S. China never deals with privatization. They prefer dealing with state entities that help build a country. No country in the world has ever developed itself through privatization. None. Right? None. Period. Every country from the U.S., the most protectionist country in the world, you know, despite all the rhetoric about free markets, to the United Kingdom, to the Asian developmental tigers in the 80s and so on, they all did it on the back of strong national development and export policies. The second point I want to make is that not only did China give this, you know, important symbolic rhetoric in the port of the developmental word, but perhaps more importantly, they let their actions speak for them as well. It's not just actions. They dropped another $2 billion development fund on the countries while they were saying we're not, this isn't just talk, we mean it with action, and more importantly with money. And of course, a large gift donation to the UN of money and 8,000 more UN peacekeeping troops as well. China was quietly, I think, at least in terms of the spirit of the United Nations, the real star there. Of course, not mentioning the very interesting fireworks between Russia, between Putin and Obama. And the last point I want to make there is about this Sino-Russian partnership. And as if we needed to make it any more clear, the UNGA speeches made perfectly clear that China and the U.S. are on one page. China and Russia are on one page. They are ever becoming closer. This is a real strategic alliance now, thanks to the United States. We should all thank Obama for doing everything he can for the last 8 years to push China and Russia so close together, you know, to form the core of this multipolar world. But that China and Russia, and I think we can include Iran now as a junior partner, and the BRICS as often being on the other BRICS as often being on board, India, Brazil, and South Africa, in defense of this sovereignty and non-interference, which we should remember is just a saying that these are the founding principles of the United Nations and the International Charter. This is not revisionism. This is saying this is a rejection of the 1990s U.S. hegemonic unipolar revisionism, yes, exactly, against the United Nations. They are not seeking to change the world order. They are seeking to restore the world order, yep, that was created post-Yalta, the Yalta system, the UN charter. And this is no longer just an axis of or an alliance of convenience. This is a settling into a firm ideological as well as geopolitical divide in the world between the West and the rest. It's no longer just sides. It's no longer just convenience. It's no longer just geopolitical. We are merging on the ideological and the philosophical. The question of a unipolar world of quote-unquote universalism, which means forcing Western values and political systems on the rest of the world, versus, shall we call it, multipolar particularism.
Yeah.
In a embrace of moral relativism by the other great world powers, particularly those that weren't conquered in the first place by Western colonialism and managed to retain their core civilizational system.
We're going to have to end it there. And I'd like to thank you guys, and we'll do this again next week. And we have a lot more to talk about just from this week. So I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week. Thanks a lot, Eric and Mark.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Don.
Thanks, guys.